You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Fighting Socialism in Latin America with Gloria Alvarez, Yaron Brook, and Agustina Vergara Cid.
All right, so we're here today to talk about socialism in Latin America and what to do to fight it. So Latin America for decades now has been some sort of socialist haven. And it has been dominated by socialist ideas for the most part for many, many years now. So I wanted to ask you, Gloria, can you give us a little bit of historical background on how Latin America came to be a predominantly socialist region?
Thank you, Agustina. So yeah, we are dominated in the 21st century by socialism in Latin America, not only because we don't learn from other people's mistakes, because I think that after the genocide of 60 million Chinese people in Mao's regime, or the genocide of the USSR, it's completely incomprehensible how people can get democratically elected proposing socialism in the 21st century, only in Latin America, where we don't learn history, we don't like to educate ourselves. In fact, we believe that the government should educate us, and that's why the government has a Marxist indoctrination that, of course, justifies socialism as the only economic way of life. But the truth is, this is not a problem of the 21st century. This is a problem that transcends every period of Latin American history. Alvaro Vargas Llosa has an excellent book called Liberty for Latin America. Why is it that neoliberalism and socialism haven't worked for the progress of our region? And he explains that there are five principles of oppression that have survived all the periods of Latin American history. Within these five principles of oppression, you can find mercantilism, wealth transfer, victimization complex, you know, like always blaming someone else for your mistakes. Using the state, the paternalism of the state, and always looking for that messiah, that caudillo, that big leader that will take care of your problems. And he makes a beautiful, well, a terrible historical analysis. It's beautiful in the way he describes it, where he sees that even before the Spanish conquista, people, Aztecs, Incas, Mayans, and other civilizations already had these five principles of oppression. These were societies that were classist, that were all about wealth transfer, with aversion to, you know, voluntary exchange. Although there is also markets, right? Because markets are everywhere, are culturally everywhere. But mostly predominated by the ruling class. This is why it was so easy for the Spanish to just come, kick out that administration, and put themselves. And of course, these five principles of oppression get enforced with Spain, with the Catholic Church, with a monopoly, because now Latin Americans tell you, oh, the capitalism that we had from Spain. What capitalism? We were monopolies of the colony. Everything that would come out of Latin America was monopolized through Sevilla in the Consejo de Indias, and the Spanish didn't allow Gypsies, Jewish, British, Germans, French people to come and live in the colonies in the beginning. So we were the monopoly of Spain, and this is how we created our economies. Then independence comes, and you would think, oh yeah, right, we are independent ourselves from this bad crown that only wants us for themselves. But no, the criollos perpetuated these five principles of oppression. And then we had dictatorships, military dictatorships, that also perpetuated these principles of oppression. So now we have socialism of the 21st century, which is the new thing of the old thing. But the truth is, we don't have culturally, institutionally, the desire for free markets, for free individuals, for free mentalities. We think that poverty is a virtue, this comes from Catholicism, right? The poorer you are, the bigger your house in heaven. And whereas if you're rich, you're mean, you're evil. And there's a despise for the entrepreneur and for the businessman. In part, it's logic, right? Because in Latin America, in order to be a successful businessman, you have to be crony. You have to be close to the state, because the state, like the crown in the past, is the one who decides who gets to trade what and with who. So only the people that are close to the populist, the dictator, the president, get to trade. So there is certain logic of why people hate the rich, and it's because these are not self-made men that have, you know, competed in a free market. They have obtained this through crony privileges. So socialism of the 21st century was the response to take out these oligarchies, but they didn't take them out. It happens as it always happens with these regimes. They just establish a new oligarchy. So it's instead of the oligarchs of the past, it's Fidel Castro and his friends, Hugo Chavez and his friends. So you see the same thing.
I agree with everything Gloria just said, but I'll just add that there is a philosophical dimension here. If you look at the history, the intellectual history of Latin America versus some other parts of the world, Latin America is dominated by continental philosophy. It never really gets John Locke and the Enlightenment, the Scottish Enlightenment, or even the French Enlightenment. They're very much dominated by German philosophy and German philosophers. So that whole school of thought that is, starts from Kant and Hegel and Schopenhauer and Marx and onward, is very dominant in Latin America. To get a PhD, you went to Europe and you went to continental Europe. You don't go to England. You didn't go. So they never studied the Anglo-Saxon philosophers. There's no concept of individual rights. There's no concept of the institutions that God liberty and God freedom. They have absorbed kind of a continental European attitude, philosophy, and institutions that have only helped to entrench this attitude, have made the people, to some extent, passively accept this authoritarianism that has been imposed on them.
And may I say that when we have a classical liberal mentality, for example, Juan Bautista Alberdi in Argentina, right? He makes the constitution that makes Argentina the third economic power by the beginning of the 20th century, before Perón, of course. But whenever we have a Juan Bautista Alberdi or a José Martí in Cuba or Simón Bolívar, who Karl Marx despised, talking about free market or individual liberties or limited government or the power of liberty, they were annihilated. Yeah. Even in Spain, the Salamanca school, who actually inspired some of the founding fathers of the United States, is completely forgotten. Or the attempt of the Cádiz Constitution in 1812, again, forgotten. So every time we have had some representatives of freedom, they are ignored, they are humiliated, they get killed. So yeah, it's been hard.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah. So Yaron, Gloria mentioned Juan Bautista Alberdi, who was one of the people that drafted the first constitution in Argentina, and he was very much inspired by the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. government. And like Gloria said, it eventually just faded away. And my question is, why do you think these kind of shifts happen? Like we had Alberdi with these great ideas, and it shifted towards socialism. And, you know, socialism has failed every time and everywhere that it has been tried, but somehow it is still attractive to people. Why is that?
Well, I think in the case of Argentina, I think generally that yes, some people at the top thought this was a good idea, classical liberalism was a good idea, but the culture never embraced it. And the philosophers and the intellectuals and the intellectual class never embraced it. They were enamored again by kind of the what they were getting from Europe, which was at the time socialism, Marxism, certainly at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, fascism. You know, Perón and others were inspired by kind of the fascist movements in Europe. So The intellectuals never adopted the classical liberal traditions, even if some political leaders for a while did. Now, why does socialism keep coming back? Partially because socialism is the dominant ideology among the intellectuals, among the intellectual elite. I mean, that's true. The left dominates the universities in the United States, never mind Latin America. The left dominates the intellectual establishment all over the world, everywhere. Add to that Catholicism. Catholicism is very bad in this mix. And what is it about Catholicism? Well, many things. But the one specific that links up to socialism is altruism. You know, Catholicism demands sacrifice. Catholicism demands that you not think about yourself, that you place the well-being of others first. Catholicism reminds you every single day of a superhero, Jesus, who dies for you. Not because he sinned. He suffered not because he sinned, not because he did anything bad, but because you did something bad. The ultimate sacrifice, and in a sense demands of you, if you want to be moral, to do the same thing. So it requires that we be selfless, and it requires sacrifice. That's socialism. In every aspect, that is socialism. Capitalism is not about being selfless. It's about being self-interested. We're each pursuing our own happiness. We're each pursuing our own career. We're each pursuing our own well-being, our own wealth, our own flourishing as individual human being. And yes, other people benefit from that, but that's not the motivation. The motivation is our own well-being. And that's selfish. And Catholicism looks at that and says, that's the devil. That is the devil. Being self-interested is the essence of sin, the essence of immorality. So capitalism is always, no matter how successful it is fundamentally viewed as sinful, as bad, as harmful, because it is self-interested, and that's what people associate with self-interest. And it's by necessity going to be crooked and fraudulent, because that's what self-interested people do, right? Well, lying, cheating, stealing, SOBs. That's what the altruists teach. And Catholicism is so well entrenched, religion generally, because there's been an evangelical kind of movement in Latin America, but it's even among the evangelicals, it's so entrenched, the altruism, that it's impossible to sustain capitalism. So even though you have a slight rise for a while, yeah, but what about the poor? And what about those suffering over there? And why can't we sacrifice these rich people to those? Ultimately, sacrifice is good. Yeah. Sacrifice isn't evil. And why don't they share? And they're being self-interested. And the meek shall inherit the earth, so the meek are the good guys. So a whole moral code, a whole approach to morality is consistent with socialism. That's why it's popular in the U.S. now. It's popular all over the world because in spite of it not working, it's right. I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez does this all the time, right? You say, but Alexandria, how are you going to pay for all these programs? And she looks at you and she says, if it's the right thing to do, in other words, if it's the moral thing to do, we will find the money. You know, in other words, we'll find the people to sacrifice and take their stuff and make it happen. But she talks in the verbiage of morality, and that morality is consistent with socialism in all its variations. And to hell with the results, to hell with the outcomes.
And Gloria, in your book, The Populist Deception, you make a similar point, arguing that socialism has greatly benefited from particularly Christianism and Catholicism.
Well, the other problem that we have, and I have it every day, in fact, in those commentaries that we're doing in the live stream, probably is happening, is that the classical liberal movement, the libertarian movement, the anarcho-capitalist movement in Latin America is rudely connected to Catholics. And now that I published a book called The Populist Deceit, where with Axel Kaiser, a Chilean economist, we make the explanation of how historically, culturally, politically, and economically, socialism of the 21st century came into place. Then I published a book called How to Talk to a Socialist, you know, to like mock myself from these young millennials and centennials that they're communists, but with iPhones, right? And they have in their iPhones the lock screen with Che Guevara. They say they're communists, but with iPhones. Don't take their Wi-Fi away. But now I also, yeah. But now I also published a book called How to Talk to a Conservative. Because I think it is necessary in Latin America to make the distinction between libertarians, anarcho-capitalists, objectivists, classical liberals, whatever you want to call it, from conservatives who only defend free markets, but they don't defend free individuals. And they don't want to get into the debate on how Catholicism and Christianity in general is deeply helping and supporting socialism, not because Gloria Álvarez says it. I mean, the theology of liberation, la teología de la liberación, a bunch of Catholic priests in Leuven, Belgium, come up with this theory where they say, well, you know what? If a priest grabs a gun in the name of Marxism, it's going to be okay. And guess what? They did it in all the Marxist guerrillas in Latin America, in Peru, in Nicaragua, in Guatemala, in El Salvador. So this has historically happened, right? When, yeah, I know, it's like, okay, Marxism is supposed to be atheist, but you know, if we can get the help of our Catholic friends, why not? So now that I have published this third book, although all my life, well, all my rational life, I've been for, you know, the freedom of beliefs. I don't care if you believe in unicorns, mermaids, Quetzalcoatl, Mitra, Zeus, Jesus Christ. You are entitled to believe in whatever you want. But don't impose those beliefs by using the state. And then, for example, don't talk about legalizing drugs or legalizing prostitution or abortion or euthanasia. Deep problems that we have in Latin America. Because by keeping these things illegal, you criminalize them. You make them profitable for the criminals. But now that's the problem. That's the challenge, right? That libertarians, the classical liberals, anarcho-capitalists, objectivists in Latin America, we are polluted by these conservatives. And they're writing books condemning homosexuality. They write books saying the Christian origins of the Western civilization. And they say to you, without Christianity, there wouldn't be any Western civilization. Without Christianity, there wouldn't be scientific developments. And you're like, my God, you were the ones who burned people for being scientists. And now you're telling me that I have to thank you because we have a Western civilization? And this is a debate that is long, it's already done in the Anglo-Saxon world. But in Latin America, we're still having it. In fact, like to give you an example, there's a book in the other room called How the Roman Empire Invented Christ, right? So I took some photos of that book, I put it in my Twitter account. It's not national television. I'm not standing in anyone's temple to prevent them from entering. No, it's my Twitter account. And people that call themselves liberals or classical liberals or libertarians in Latin America, they grab those images and says, how dare she? And they're like, yeah, you know, she's a socialist. It turns out that if you're not Christian and defending free market, they put you in the corner of you're a Marxist, you're a socialist. This is the battle that we have right now in Latin America. It's really difficult because for decades, the libertarian movement has been embedded within this conservatism, and objectivism is even less known. I mean, we are the weirdos for proposing limited government and, you know, separation of economics and state. But objectivism, oh, no, that's even way more unknown.
Yeah, I mean, I wish it was true that that battle had been won in the Anglo-Saxon world. It doesn't feel like that in the United States. And I think that's right. And one of the reasons we objectivists resist the label of libertarian and resist being lumped together with all these groups is exactly that. We don't agree on pretty fundamental things, on really, really important stuff. I don't believe that religion is consistent with liberty. You can be religious under liberty, but if you're trying to justify liberty through religion, it's going to fail, and it's going to fail miserably. And to the extent that a culture is religious, to the extent that it is religious, to that extent, it will never be free. That is, religion has, in some way, has to be diminished, has to be privatized, has to be put in your private home and away from the public square in order for freedom to be able to arise. And that's what the founders did in the United States. But in Latin America, that separation has never happened. But it's also never happened in the minds of the thinkers. It is uniquely Latin America phenomena to have Catholic Marxists who take their Catholicism seriously and their Marxism seriously and have combined them. That doesn't really exist in Europe. Although, again, I think there are lots of similarities between Marxism and Catholicism. I think Marx is very Christian in many respects. Christian, not in a belief in faith, but in his kind of altruism and his kind of collectivism, very similar to Christianity. But in Latin America, that's been combined, and it's a powerful force because everybody shares the moral code. Very few people are willing to challenge the religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. And then many of the free market advocates, the better people, you would think, are then also, you know, real religionists. And as a consequence, you can't really support them, and they undercut their own arguments. They undercut their own case because they're not willing to be truly for freedom. And this is why it's so hard. Until we manage to separate the idea of freedom from the idea of religion, it's going to be very hard in America and in Latin America to actually move forward in a persistent way. I think we'll still get ups and downs. We'll still get movements in the right direction. But to stick to it, to stick it, it's going to take challenging religion. And that's hard in the U.S., and it's even harder in Latin America.
I absolutely agree. I spent most of my life living in Argentina, and there's this false dichotomy that you guys were essentially talking about. Well, you're either a conservative or you're a socialist, yep. And that is not true. There are other alternatives, such as like we are, right? But let's talk a little bit now about what is currently going on and happening nowadays in Latin America. Mm-hmm. So, Gloria, in your book, How to Talk to a Socialist, you describe what socialists tend to do and argue for in Latin America. And could you tell us a little bit more about that and what kind of socialist policies governments implement in Latin America?
All of them. You read the Communist Manifesto of Marx from 1 to 10, all of them. One and another time again. They start with the false dichotomy of people and anti-people, right? The enemies of the people. Of course, the people is the leader and anyone that supports the leader. If you don't support the leader, then you are the enemy of the people. The people is virtuous. The people are treated unfairly. The people are poor, and this is funny, right? Because the populist leader always says, "Well, here's the people, and they've been mistreated, and they are poor, and here are the rich, the oligarchs, the mean guys, the evil ones, and they can take three forms. Is it the gringos? Because of course the gringos are for everything to blame in Latin America. We're not the responsibles of our own disasters. No, it's always the gringos or the Spanish conquista, right? That happened 500 years ago. I mean, you don't see the Japanese complaining that 70 years ago they had not the Spanish conquistadors, that's peanuts compared to 2 atomic bombs, right? I rather have the Spanish conquering me any day than having 2 atomic bombs. I don't know about you guys, but you don't see the Japanese complaining, oh no, you know, 70 years ago we had 2 atomic bombs, so this is why we're poor. Well, in Latin America, you hear people saying, no, we're poor because, you know, 500 years ago we had conquistadores and we had the gringos that are always the ones to blame, and of course, the national oligarchy. Those are always like the 3 enemies to blame for everything. So first you have to divide into these 2 imaginary collectives that of course don't exist. You annul the individual by this. You create hatred in society. Then within individuals, people don't talk anymore. They don't debate because of course, like you don't want to make anyone uncomfortable. So let's not debate. Let's not talk. And once you inserted that, then any economic measure that aligns with socialism is justified. Price controls, minimum wage, expropriation, nationalization, censorship. If a newspaper is talking bad about the leader, but the leader is doing the good for the people, then that newspaper needs to be shut down or nationalized, right, or expropriated. So then they implement the 10 steps of the Communist Manifesto. Of course, this ends in misery, in riots, in children dying of starvation, like it's happening in Venezuela, in Nicaragua, in Cuba. but then they say, oh no, this was not socialism. Turns out, and this is the other thing that I don't understand two things about socialists. They say to you, I will take you away of poverty. You will need me because I am the Messiah. I am the leader. I know how to take care of you. You're too poor, too dumb to think for yourself. Don't worry. I'll expropriate the rich so you can be taken out of poverty. But at the same time, you're telling those people that being rich is being bad. So if I was a poor person listening to this message, I would be like, wait a minute. So you're telling me that being rich is being bad, but you're also telling me that you're going to take me out of poverty. So then what? I become one of those rich, mean people? That doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, you would think it doesn't make any sense, but this is how people win elections in Latin America. The level of debate is so low, so pathetic, so mediocre, that this is how you win, with things that are evidently incoherent. You know, it's like A is not A, A is B, A is Z, A is X, A is whatever the leader says, and it changes every day. That is one thing. The other thing is that they are praised as the leader that finally is putting a stop to the Yankee Empire and the gringos, and we're gonna have a national economy. Oh my God, Fidel Castro, so good. Hugo Chavez, what a guy. Okay? Once that socialism fails, as it always does and it always will, turns out that those gringos were all the way inside the conspiracy. And now they tell you, no, in Venezuela it's not the fault of socialism, it's the fault of the gringos. There are people in Venezuela who actually believe that every night the gringos go to the supermarkets to take everything out, and that's why there's a scarcety. Yes. I mean, there are people in North Korea that think that their leader doesn't go to the toilet. So, you know, like, once you implement the ridiculousness, the absurdity, and you diminish reason, it's like Animal Farm. You can repaint the rules as you want it. You can say any crazy idea that you want. How do you fight this, right? Thank you.
It's that, I mean, the contradiction you say about, you know, we hate the rich, but we want to make you rich, and well, what happens when we become rich? I mean, that's one of the essential contradictions in altruism, right? Fundamentally, in altruism is you should sacrifice to other people. Their happiness should be important to you. But what are they supposed to do? Once I sacrifice to them, they're supposed to find people who are more miserable than them and sacrifice to them. And what do? They have to sacrifice somebody else. It's a continuous circle of sacrifice that never really ends, because as soon as it ends with you, I'm not sacrificing.
Exactly.
Then you're the bad guy. You're evil. So as poor as you are, you're supposed to sacrifice to the whoever's poorer than you, whoever's on the verge of death. And that's one of the insanities and contradictions that inherit in altruism, and therefore is inherent in any system built on altruism.
And, well, Gloria, you mentioned Venezuela, and, we're seeing the news every day how Venezuela has completely and absolutely collapsed. Mm. And I wanted to ask you, because we see this in the news all the time, but not everyone is very clear on what exactly is going on there right now. Can you give us a brief explanation?
Yeah, it's like the apocalypse zombie. If you ever watch The Walking Dead or any zombie movies, that's what's going on. Now, let me tell you why it's happening. Because what's going on in Venezuela, you can look at the videos, you can see at the pictures, is the same that happened in the famine of the Great Leap Forward in China, or the gulags in the Soviet Union. The same thing. It's the same result. It's only that now it's Venezuelans instead of Russians or Chinese. Why? Why do we got there? Well, this is why it's so important to understand cause and effect. Because the saddest thing is listening to a Venezuelan that tells you, no, but you know, Venezuela is not socialism's fault. It's the fault of corruption. because there is no rational logic in the way people think, and this has been destroyed by Marxist indoctrination, not only in public schools, also in private schools, right? It comes from both. So people think that first comes corruption, and then socialism doesn't work. They don't understand that, as Lord Acton said, absolute power corrupts absolutely. What is socialism? Is giving absolute economic power to the government. So if you give absolute economic power to the government, the consequence is corruption. So first comes socialism, then comes corruption. I dare you to ask 10 Latin American people if the problem is first corruption or socialism, and I bet they will say it's first corruption. They don't get it, and it's so sad. It's so sad to listen to a Venezuelan when he tells you, no, you know, it's not the fault of socialism. Socialism is good. The problem is corruption. That is as sad as if you would listen to a Holocaust survivor telling you that, no, the problem of the concentration camps wasn't the Nazis. It was corruption. No, really, it is horrible. It's sad because people don't understand what is that is killing them. Now, how do we get here? So, it all starts, of course, with the USSR and this idea of expanding communism everywhere in the planet. The first franchise that we had in Latin America of this killing machine was Fidel Castro in Cuba, 1959, right? So when Fidel Castro is successful implementing a Marxist guerrilla to attain power, the USSR starts putting in money to replicate the model in a copy-paste way during the Cold War, making Marxist guerrillas everywhere in Latin America. We had a civil war in Guatemala that lasted 36 years. El Salvador, the same. Honduras, the same. Nicaragua, the same. Uruguay. Argentina had its attempt of Marxist guerrilla. In Peru, you had Sendero Luminoso. And the most successful of all these Marxist guerrillas of them all, because then they became a drug cartel, is FARC in Colombia. So from 1959 until 1989, you have these copy-paste models trying to emulate what Castro did in Cuba. But guess what? The Soviet Union collapsed, and most of these guerrillas didn't make it. We also passed from military dictatorships to democratic regimes in Latin America, so we start, you know, choosing our own populists instead of being dictatorially implemented. And because of this, Fidel Castro was very astute, and he said, how are we gonna, you know, stay in power? And he first approached a union leader. He was very charismatic, very well known in a very rich country, because Cuba has the brains, but they need the money, right, to sustain this this regime. First, the money came from the USSR. When that collapses after the Berlin Wall falls, you need to, come up with new ways of money. So his first protege was Lula da Silva in Brazil. Imagine Brazil, like a super millionaire nation. And in the 90s, they start gathering in their own international socialist called Sao Paulo Foro. And this forum unites every year to advance in the agenda. They are super organized. They know what to do politically, economically. But then someone did something better than Lula da Silva, and that was Hugo Chavez. In 1993, Hugo Chavez makes a military coup in Venezuela, and Castro says, maybe let's go with this guy, because Venezuela has oil, so it's as rich as Brazil. Since then, socialism shifted from violence, abandoning Marx, and adopting Antonio Gramsci, the founder of the Italian Communist Party. And Antonio Gramsci said, no, the way that socialism works, or communism, is not through violence, it's not the class struggle, it's cultural hegemony. We need to dominate the culture. And to dominate the culture, you need to dominate art, universities, schools, what people talk in churches, what people talk in their families, cultural hegemony. and through cultural hegemony, you win elections. Since then, the Foro of Sao Paulo, this regime of socialism of the 21st century, has inputted not only Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Lula da Silva in Brazil, Los Kirchner in Argentina, Bachelet in Chile, Mujica in Uruguay, Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, Evo Morales in Bolivia, Rafael Correa in Ecuador. Now, López Obrador, the new guys are the Mexicans trying this. And in the countries that they haven't dominated yet, they have their franchise or their political party running in elections to win. So what you see in Venezuela is only the metastasis of a cancer that is spread all over Latin America, except that Venezuela is in the last stages of mortality. It's like the leukemia is everywhere. But in the rest, it depends on how strong your institutions are. If you have strong institutions, like the case of Uruguay and Chile, you cannot finish the list of the Communist Manifesto as efficiently as you can in places where you have no institutions whatsoever. So that's what's going on in Venezuela and why it is going on in Venezuela.
And I think part of the point is the Cubans are behind it all, in a sense, intellectually, with manpower. I doubt the Venezuela regime would still be around today if not for the Cuban involvement in Venezuela itself, supporting the military, supporting Maduro. And, you know, the Cubans are sending people everywhere where there are these socialist parties. They're sending them to Mexico. They're sending them elsewhere. But Cuba is, its foreign policy is, to get this Marxist agenda out to all these countries, particularly countries that with money, they can send that money back to Cuba because the Cuba economy is horrific. The only way they survive is by squeezing money out of places like Venezuela and now Mexico.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, Iran, you know, Venezuela looks like it's been taken straight out of Atlas Shrugged, basically. And do you think that there is hope for Venezuela if Juan Guaido, this new guy, takes Maduro out of power?
So, I mean, the challenge is that the opposition is, as Gloria said, they're socialists. they're not opposers of socialism. They just think they'll do it right this way, this time. Now, it's hard for me to say whether they really believe that or that is the only way they think they can maintain power. That is, do the people involved in the opposition party in Venezuela believe in socialism? Are they using it because they know that's what many of the masses still adhere to in spite of what's happened over there? I suspect that there are enough smart people there that have seen what has happened that they will reverse many of the policies that led to where we are today. But that will just start the cycle over again because they won't have challenged the fundamental beliefs. They won't have challenged the fundamental assumptions of socialism. They won't have even challenged the idea of socialism. They'll just practically do better things so that it swings in the positive direction. How long that's sustainable, I don't know. But I'm not particularly optimistic because they really do believe that the government has a huge role to play in the economy. They might shrink it a little bit in order to spur economic growth. Even Lenin did that, right, in the 20s. Lenin in the USSR saw that the economy was collapsing, and he basically established pseudo-property rights for a while. Okay, so you can keep the profits a little bit while, and the economy of the USSR recovered in time for them to squeeze it again. And whether that'll be a pattern or not, it really depend on who are the leaders that come up in Venezuela. Clearly, I think both of us know people in Venezuela who are very good, real classical liberals, people who really believe in freedom and believe in capitalism. But whether they have a voice in a reborn Venezuela or in a post-Maduro Venezuela is so hard to tell, given the chaos over there. But it's hard to be optimistic. Do they have their Chicago boys, as Chile did? They're there. The people who know the stuff are there. But will they be given the reins of control over the economy so that they can change things? We will see, but I doubt it.
One of the things that I've observed about people that want to actually change the predominant, you know, socialist society that they live in Latin America is that they think that just being anti-socialism is enough. Like, you have to, like, knock it down, kill it. But is it, Yaron, is it enough to just be anti-socialism?
No, it really is not. You have to offer a positive alternative. You have to be for something. And you have to make the case for the thing that you're for. And it has to be a moral case, not just an economic case. It has to be a case for human success and human flourishing and people as individuals doing well. And it has to demolish this idea of the evil of success and the evil of wealth. No, being against something just, you know, so they'll go to a different form of authoritarianism. You have to be for individual rights. The ideas, the Anglo-Saxon ideas that come out of the Scottish Enlightenment or the English Enlightenment, the fundamental ideas that come out of the United States, the vision of the United States, those ideas have to be promoted. And ultimately, I think it's the free market economists and it's Ayn Rand who are the only modern representatives of these ideas, and they have to be promoted in Latin America. So for Latin America to be successful, not that everybody's going to become an objectivist, but at least that should be the thrust. That should be the dominant ideology that people know. Yeah, it's kind of radical, but that's the direction we're heading, even if we never actually reach there. And many of the free market economists who not only show that socialism doesn't work, but show that capitalism does.
Yeah.
That combination has to happen. You have to have the morality from objectivism and the free market economics from classical liberalism. That combination and the institutions of classical liberalism, kind of the institutions, the separation of powers, the independence of the judiciary, these fundamental institutions that came out of the Enlightenment that allow for the success of free societies in the West, those don't exist in Latin America, and they need to be established. But it's going to be very difficult. We haven't talked about Brazil, but I think Brazil is going to be somewhere to watch and to see what actually happens. And if there's one positive spot in Latin America, it is Brazil, but we'll see. I mean, it's still an experiment that's happening.
Gloria, you're one of the few intellectuals in Latin America who's actually given that fight and defending capitalism. Can you tell us a little bit more about what fighting socialism in Latin America looks like to you?
Yes.
It's hard work.
It's really hard, especially because what Yaron was saying, right? Like, capitalism shouldn't be defended only by the economic side, but by the moral side, and giving people that philosophical principle. And that's what people hear. Oh, moral equals religion. So capitalism should be fought from the Christians or the Catholics, not by a radical atheist like myself, right? So it's really hard because you're trying to do two battles. You're trying to make people understand the principles of free market economics, but you also are trying to show them that without religion, there is morality, without religion, there is ethics, and actually, if we wouldn't have that many religion, we would be better off. It is not a causality that the more religion you have, the better people behave, because the countries where the majority of people are non-believers have less killings and less robberies than Latin America, where 95% of the people are believers. So there's no correlation in between religious and ethics. But it's hard. It's easier if you are a capitalist Catholic or a capitalist Protestant, because then people say, oh, okay, you know, it's in the good side. But the problem is when you ally with these people, things that I think are crucial for Latin America get not inside of the discussion. For example, I launched a presidential campaign. It was symbolic because in my country, which has, my constitution has my age. We are both from 1985. That's how young Guatemalan democracy is. So a 34-year-old constitution says that you have to be 40 years old to be president. That's okay. So I launched this presidential campaign because we are in the verge of disaster. I mean, we had a mayor that disguised himself as Iron Man. I kid you not. You can see the videos in my social media to get reelected, and he did. It's not that politicians do this crazy stuff, it's that people applauded and voted. The level of debate in Guatemala is terrible. And I saw the same in Mexican elections, even in Brazil, Brazilian elections, Argentinian elections. Like, the level of debate is really low. Anyhow, in this presidential campaign, I propose 5 economic non-negotiable things to basically re-engineer the government of Guatemala, which include annulling the health and education unions, reducing the state from 14 ministries to only 4, implementing the flat tax, making each state — in Guatemala, states are called departments — make each department accountable for their own taxes, not everything coming to the capital city. Those were like the economic non-negotiables. This is where the Catholics, evangelics, whatever religion, they love me. But then I did 10 optional things for people to choose 5. Inside of those, I included legalizing abortion, legalizing prostitution, cocaine and marijuana, homosexual marriage, homoparental adoption, euthanasia, voluntary sale of your organs. If you want to sell your kidney, why not? It's yours, private property, right? Okay. So I put these 10 things, right? So it doesn't matter that I have the logic of the 5 economic principles, as long as people hear drugs, sex, homosexuality, abortion, is like, no. You cannot go with the right wing of Latin America with this kind of agenda, because they're gonna say no. So that's my problem when people vote for the right, for the Bolsonaros, for the Macris, mm-hmm, in Argentina, or for the Iván Duques in Colombia. They are not willing to do the things that are crucial. And by crucial, okay, maybe we can wait for gay marriage. But if we don't legalize drugs in Latin America, if we don't legalize it to liberalize it, we are not gonna have transparent politics. Because drugs and politics are the same. Cartels run our governments. From Mexico and Colombia, which are like the biggest ones, and all of Central America, which we are countries of passway, if we don't legalize drugs, we're gonna keep on having narco-violence, narco-corruption, and narco-politics. And this is something that no one in the right-wing, conservative, Catholic, evangelic, whatever you wanna call it, politicians want to talk about. And for me, it's crucial. So what do you do, right? What do you do when you know that the right things to do need to be done yesterday, and there are no offer? And of course, you're not gonna go to the Marxists, because they say, yeah, let's legalize drugs. Yeah, but they want to
enslave us all.
To estatize it, right? For the state to have the monopoly on who produces what. And so that's not alternative. But for me, it is crucial. It is imperative, and we need to do it. If we don't, then people go back in the pendulum. What you have in Latin America is pendulos. You have cronies of the right wing ruling in the 90s with crony privatizations. That, yes, they got us a little bit of progress. I'm not gonna say no. If any of you visited Latin America in the 80s and you visit it today, you're gonna see more electricity, more drinkable water, more technology, more internet. I mean, it's undeniable that Latin America has had economic progress. But since there was a lot of cronyism, the basement of society gets envious, gets resented, because it's not easy for them as it is for the people in power to open businesses, right? There's mercantilism, there's cronyism. So when these people get mad, they vote for the socialist lunatics. When the socialist lunatics starve them to death, they go back to the right-wing cronist. But it's always a pendulum. You don't see someone that is actually willing to do what needs to be done.
So when she turns 40, she's running for president.
Yes, vote for me. No, I don't know.
So
we should take questions.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you one last question, though, Yaron. We need to leave time, but, you know, Ayn Rand talks extensively about sense of life in the Romantic Manifesto, yeah, as we know. But she also talks about sense of life in other works. And one of them is her essay, Don't Let It Go, in the book Philosophy Who Needs It. And she talks about a nation's sense of life. and how important that is. So I wanted to ask you, do you think the fight for capitalism and individualism is harder in Latin America than it is in the U.S. because of the difference in the sense of life of each region?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. And I think Latin America's sense of life has been molded more by Catholicism, by religion, by the depressive side of Catholicism and religion, and by Marxism. Marxism has been there and been at the surface for a very long time and embraced. There is much more pessimism. There's a little bit. There's more mysticism in the Latin American sense of life. More fatalism in the Latin American sense of life. There's less of this idea that still is in America, although I think it's fading, of self-made man, of being successful as an individual, going out there and doing things, changing the world. So it's hard to bring about change because a lot of Latin Americans go, things never change,
yeah.
Right? There's the pendulum, it's going to be here, it's going to be there. Why fight? Why bother? We'll leave. Or we'll stay and we'll just live with it. So there's that fatalism that is part of the Latin American sense of life. So it's going to be hard. But look, I'll also say that it's hard everywhere. It may be marginally harder, but who knows where it will spark, right? Where who will make a difference and how that difference will be made. That's why I'm excited about Gloria running for president. and I've offered my services as an advisor for free.
Yes.
So we're in 6 years?
Eight.
8 years, yeah. we're gonna be talking. because you never know what'll actually get the thing moved around. What kind of ideas? Who will be delivering those ideas? In Guatemala, the nice thing about Guatemala is Guatemala has this amazing university in it, Universidad Francisco Marroquín, which is a university really based on classical liberal principles. Yeah. The business school has a 2-story high statue of Atlas Shrugged, with a quote from John Galt at the bottom, just to make sure that you know this is not just any Atlas, it's Galt. It has a Friedman Auditorium, a Hayek Library, a Mises this, pictures of Ayn Rand all over the place. So there's an educational institution, and so who knows if things won't, you know, we can't move Guatemala a little bit in the future. So you can't just give up because it's going to be harder. I think they're lined up.
Thank you, Yaron. Thank you, Gloria.
Thank you.
We will now open the floor to questions.
Gracias.
Man, you are one courageous, brave soul. I'm just,
yes.
You're wonderful.
Thank you.
What Yaron just mentioned about the Universidad Francisco Marroquín was going to be my question to you, because I know that this is a hotbed of the thought of the Austrians, Ludwig von Mises and Hayek and those. And I'm wondering, what is your opinion on how this is playing out? Is this really, truly, are you seeing, I hear all this pessimism about the philosophy and the two false alternatives that you were talking about. How is this playing out at the university, and what is your opinion of the prospects coming forth from the Universidad Francisco Marroquín?
I mean, it's not guaranteed that if you study there, you become a libertarian,
yeah,
or an objectivist. I actually know two sad cases. Luis Guillermo Pineda, he was a student with me in 2003, and before, I read Atlas Shrugged when I was 24, right? So I first go through Marroquín, learning about Hayek and Mises and Bastiat, and Rand was always there, but I finally read the book when I was 24, and I was like, oh my God, this woman puts the passion in the ideas that I've been reading, you know, for entire college. This guy, he was an objectivist in freshman year, so we were already 17. And I don't know what happened to him, but then he came to Ocon, I think, several times. He was super objectivist, but then he shifted like 180 degrees, and now he's a socialist.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
And so we also have a guy that graduated from the business school Martin Rodriguez Pellecer. He's one of what I like to call socialista caviar, like, you know, socialist with iPhone, and he lives in Zone 14, which is one of the richest and poshest zones of Guatemala. But he runs this newspaper where what they spread is socialism. So it's not a guarantee that if you graduate from Francisco Marroquín, you're going to become a freedom fighter. And some of the kids that go there, because granted, this is a private university and the rich people gets more access to it. But it is one thing true. They do put merit over last name. It doesn't matter who you are. It matters how hard you work and excellence. And so it's the only university in Guatemala that ends up having less students than more students by the end of the career. But, and yes, there it's growing. Now it has a campus in Madrid. It's the first university in Latin America having a campus in Spain. It also has one in Panama. So it's doing a great job. Now they have this film faculty. They made a Quijote de la Mancha MOOC open course with beautiful graphics, like Pixar quality, and they're teaching the principles of Quijote de la Mancha through liberty, right? The messages that are there. So I think there are important efforts that the university is doing, and we also owe to Manuel Ayau the fact that Guatemala doesn't have inflation, because that guy in 1993, when he was in Congress with a bunch of other congressmen, they made it illegal for the central bank to print money every time the government of Guatemala asked them to.
Amazing.
So we don't have the inflations that Argentinians, Brazilians, or Venezuelans have because of that. So, yeah.
Oh, wonderful work. Brava. Again, you're like a cross between Thomas Jefferson and Dagny Taggart.
My God.
You go.
Thank you so much.
Hello. So, there was an A word that came up a couple times that I, you know, kind of triggered me. But in the United States, we know that people who are or describe themselves or actually share anarchist ideas, we know them either to be either evil people or people who espouse evil ideas. I'm not 100% sure what your ideas of this would be. Do you see anarchists, you know, like the von Mises people, as being sort of either allies or, I guess that is a question in advancing liberty in South America and Latin America in general.
I don't know if I, is for me the question?
More for Dr. Brooke.
Okay. Can they?
Oh, that's easy, if it's for me.
Can we dim the light a little bit, please?
No, I mean, I don't think anarcho-capitalist, I don't like the term because anarchists cannot be capitalist. Capitalism requires government. You cannot have capitalism without government. I don't think they're allies. I don't think they're our friends. I don't think they are advocating for liberty in the right. They're not advocating for liberty to the extent that they take those ideas seriously. I will say this, the anarchists managed to attract a lot of young people and a lot of young, I'd say, rationalistic people who don't really have experience with the world and understanding of the world. So I wouldn't give up on a young person who happens to be an anarchist. And I wouldn't deem them evil, even though I think the ideas are such. So I have no problem speaking to young anarchists and engaging with them. And everywhere I go, every talk I've ever given in any country, anyone on the planet, from Mongolia to Tbilisi to Latin America, I always get the anarchy question because it's on the minds of a lot of young people, and they have done a great job at marketing their ideas. So while they're not our allies, I don't want to give up on the young people in terms of being able to flip them to our side. I think it's really, really important that we who defend liberty recognize government as a necessary good, not a necessary evil. That without government, there is no such thing. There is no freedom. There is no defense of individual rights, that it's anarchy without a government. And that's not a good thing.
Hi. Two more questions, and then we have to wrap up.
You talked about you going to this university, but I was wondering if you could share a bit more about how your eyes were opened. You know, if you grew up in an environment that was completely socialist. How did you end up here?
It was, like Ayn Rand says, a little bit of nurture, nature, and decision, I guess. So I come from, my dad is Cuban, my mom is half Hungarian, half Guatemalan, so I'm the best product that communism has come up with. No, I always do that joke because, they are from both sides of my families, they're communism runaways, and they ended up in Guatemala. And I knew that communism was bad because my grandparents taught me all about it. But hating communism, which is something that you pointed out, hating communism doesn't make you a freedom lover immediately, right? I still thought that, you know, the government should take care of the poor and have these plans and health and redistribution and all of this. I chose UFM because it was the only university, aside from the State University of Guatemala, which is a disaster. They're always on strike, and the state Marxist universities, what can you expect? So I was like, no, I will choose UFM. I actually didn't want to go there because that was like the university of the rich kids, right? And I'm more like middle class. But I was like, no, either I'm with the people that I want or I study what I want. And I wanted to study international affairs. To do what? I had no idea. I just knew I loved the contents, the table of contents, history, political philosophy, economics, and all of this. When I started, I actually was very cynical because they start teaching you economic process. You start reading, well, the first assignment was George Orwell, Animal Farm, which of course I was like, yeah, no kidding. This is what my grandparents have always taught me. But then you read Henry Hazlitt, Adam Smith, Tocqueville, the guys from Public Choice. You have a Mises semester. You have a Hayek semester. And I was very cynical. I once went to a professor and said, you know what, Caio? I think I'm going to put a drugstore. And he was like, a drugstore? And I'm like, yeah. And every time someone comes with a disease or a problem or some, you know, affection, I'm going to give them a little paper. And the little paper is going to say, don't you worry, the free market cures everything. And he was like, you cynical. And I'm like, well, for you guys, it seems like that, right? It's like, as long as we have free market, everything will be beautiful. The moment that it clicked me is when I read The Constitution of Liberty of Hayek, and he talks about how being free is being responsible. And in that moment, I was struggling in my life because everyone had an opinion on my job, on what I was studying. My parents were divorcing. Like, I was in a period of, should I listen to people or should I do my own thing? And the philosophical side of being free means that you're responsible and therefore other people's opinions don't matter as yours, it like, you know, opened my eyes. Then I went to study abroad. I went to do an internship at the Cato Institute, and I saw how those guys were more pragmatic than my university to make public policy. And I said, okay, here is a clue. Then I went to the other side. I went to Europe. I studied in Marxist universities. I said, okay, definitely Marxism, not the way. I go back home. I always did radio, and this time, through radio, I started talking to people about these ideas in a way that was, like Alex Epstein said, bridge the message from where you are and where you want to get them. And by this point, I am, you know, the crazy radio broadcaster talking about libertarian and objectivist ideas. Everyone in my country thought that I was a little bit insane. So this is from 2010 to 2014. 2014, I go to Spain to this Congress. I give a speech, which was, you know, common sense. Let's use technology to dismantle the lives of all these populist regimes. They put it on YouTube. It goes viral. Like in 3 days, 1 million people from all over Latin America. From one day to the next, I become famous in all Latin America, and the crazy radio girl that talked about these crazy free market ideas becomes, you know, someone that people actually want to listen to. And since then, I've been giving maybe like 1,000 conferences and working, giving advisory to young students, to people, and whoever wants to listen or debate, I'm here.
That's very inspiring, great. Gloria. All right, thank you, Yaron. Thank you, Gloria.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.